on one retreat a few years ago when I was practicing with Sayadaw, he described in one of the interview groups that a lot of yogis had asked him the question, you know, given the very simplicity of this practice, there can sometimes be this feeling of like, well, what am I supposed to do? Is it really just settle back and receive, receive, receive? Is it just a non-doing practice? And he came up with a response framed through the, I think he was kind of, he liked the notion of yogis having jobs, the yogi jobs that we have. And so he came up with this three yogi jobs that is our work for our practice. And these three yogi jobs, this is what we're encouraged to do with our practice. Cultivate right view. Practice mindfulness. And practice mindfulness continuously. So I'd like to explore some of the ways we can do this in our practice. So the cultivating right view is about learning or connecting with a perspective that makes mindfulness, that creates the conditions for mindfulness to actually be freeing, for it to lead towards the release of dukkha. Kind of a perspective that's connected with how we practice. Sometimes I remind us all that in the suttas, actually, the Buddha spoke of right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness. And so mindfulness alone can be almost considered a neutral quality. It can be influenced by greed, aversion, delusion, or it can be influenced by wisdom, this perspective of right view. And for this purposes, the perspective of right view for our practice, that the orientation towards how can I find freedom from suffering, the perspective is one of understanding suffering. Really, the classic definition of right view in the suttas is there is suffering. With the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. With the ending of craving is the ending of suffering. And there is a path that we can cultivate that leads to this ending of suffering, this release of craving. And so the understanding embedded in those Four Noble Truths is that the craving and the ignorance connected with that craving are at the root or at the kind of the source or the kind of ground out of which our suffering it grows. And so understanding that is an important aspect of our practice. And this, to me, is really a key piece of right view, that very first noble truth, action associated with the noble truths. All of the noble truths have an action associated with them. We are encouraged to understand suffering, to let go or release the craving, that is the arising of craving is the arising of suffering, to let go of the craving, to realize for ourselves this release of suffering, this ending of suffering, and to cultivate the path, the Eightfold Path. And very much the cultivating of the path is a piece of the activity that we do. And the Eightfold Path begins with right view, which takes us back to the Four Noble Truths. So really there's a kind of this kind of circular process or path embedded in the way the teachings are even described. that right view is the beginning of the path, really. We have to have some perspective or understanding in order to even step on the path. And this action associated with the First Noble Truth, understand suffering. To me, that is kind of the crux of our practice. And all of the Eightfold Path are tools that help us to understand suffering. To understand suffering in the moment, to understand its arising, to see the craving and the ignorance that are participating in the experience of suffering, and understand, recognize that they're optional, that they are not destined to happen, but are conditioned based on our history, and some of it is conditioned on kind of being born into a human body. And so this understanding suffering as it actually is a key piece of right view. And these actions that are associated with right view, to me, take what might be simply considered as a bunch of beliefs and ideas to think about into direct experience within our practice. The Buddha encourages us to engage with these as practice. Understand suffering. How do we understand suffering? How do we go about that? And so this perspective of using mindfulness, we use mindfulness to help understand suffering. I don't remember if I said early in the retreat, maybe one of you can remind me if I mentioned, like, with wrong mindfulness, the mindfulness of a thief. Did I talk about that? No. Okay. So a thief might be going through a house to steal things, very aware of the moment, very aware of the present moment, knowing exactly their sound, their movement, their touching. So very present in the present moment. But the motivation for that presence is not, can I learn what it's like to be moving and touching, and can I understand the mind? The motivation for that thief is greed. And so that whole process of being present in the moment for that thief is not conducive to freedom. It actually is supporting the cultivation of greed. And so to me, this is this understanding around wrong mindfulness. This is what the Buddha was pointing to when he said there is wrong mindfulness. And so the view or the perspective, the intention that we are engaged in the mindfulness with is important. And the way that we explore and what we're doing here, I mean, the whole practice that we're engaged in here to understand our minds, to be curious about what is our human experience, that's a kind of a simple way to begin to frame, you know, a practical way to begin to frame how right view comes into the mindfulness that we practice. We are interested in understanding our minds, understanding suffering, understanding our human experience. And so just a few things or a few perspectives that kind of embed this that we've been talking about already, but to just point to this perspective that you're already working with is bringing right view into the practice. So you're already doing this one. So I want you to not, you know, feel like, oh no, this is something else I have to pick up. The way that we're practicing already is bringing this right view in, bringing this perspective, curiosity to what is this experience? In a way, the simplicity of just understanding experience that's arising as experience that is arising in the present moment embeds this right view. That thief is not interested in understanding what's it like to take a step. What's it like to reach and touch? What's it like to have these thoughts arising in the mind? that's not what they're doing with that presence. They're interested in what they can get out of that experience. And so just this simple, can we be curious about what is happening as something that is happening? The recognition, oh, this is what's arising. Frustration is arising. Seeing is arising. What's the experience of seeing versus looking? This is this perspective that we're pointing towards, the curiosity of what's happening in the present moment. This is not, has not perhaps been our usual perspective until we meet the Dharma, until we meet this practice. Our usual way of engaging is to, when we meet experience, even when we become aware of it, is to pick it up as an agenda to further our goals that our sense of self has often. And so this just simple shift. Can I know experience as experience? This is an object that's arising. This is an experience. What is the experience? How is it felt? And as we explore that, we begin to recognize when something is arising that is suffering, and when something is arising that has the sense of the release of suffering. So we recognize the suffering. This is another aspect of wisdom, understanding suffering. We understand suffering as suffering, not as something that I need to fix or change, but as something to be understood. And so in this exploration of what is arising in this moment, another piece of this wise view is that any experience can be used to cultivate mindfulness. Any experience. Whatever's arising, whatever experience is arising, is a dharma. It's a process of body and mind that bears the wisdom or the truth of impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. Every single thing we experience has this. We call them the characteristics. This is the name that the commentarial tradition puts on those three aspects. Characteristics of experience. The Buddha encourages us to cultivate the perceptions of impermanent, unreliable, not self. Every single experience has this that can be seen about it, that can be understood about it, without exception. It's at times we may be caught by something and not able to see these impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable nature of experience. We may be caught by something and not able to see it. But that doesn't mean that inherently that experience, it's not possible to be mindful of. That's one of the keys here. And in my own practice, this is, I think, one of the key wisdoms that at this point there's such deep trust in. Maybe there's an arising of something right now that I'm not quite able to be with, that the mind gets stuck or caught to. But there's a deep trust that it's not inherent in that thing, that I can't be mindful of it. It's something in the mind. There's some stuckness or some reactivity, some greed, aversion, confusion, delusion present that is in the way of that possibility to be mindful. And so there's this kind of attempt, or the kind of just connecting with, okay, well, right now it feels kind of hard, but let's just keep trying. Maybe there's a way to meet this. I know there's a way to meet it. I just haven't quite touched that yet. And of course, as we've been talking about, there are times in our practice that certain reactive states are stronger than our capacity to be mindful in the moment. And so we use some of our tools to create balance, to allow us to step back from the reactivity around it a bit. And as we've been talking in the groups, that balance can then allow us to kind of maybe step forward and meet that experience, even just a little bit. And so we use our tools to help create a little balance, not so that we can get away from something, but so that we can kind of gather our resources to touch back in to learn about that experience. At one point, Sayadaw, in his, he was speaking in English, and the way he framed this understanding just had such a nice resonance to it. He said something like, "Objects can't disturb you." What's happening in your own mind? It's the disturbance. The disturbance is happening in your relationship to an experience. And that is what we're interested in observing, in knowing, in seeing. And so in some ways we could say that whatever is arising, that experience is the best place to cultivate mindfulness, because it's arising and mindfulness only happens now. And again, with the caveat that sometimes certain arisings are so sticky that mindfulness is not available. But again, it's not inherent in the experience that mindfulness isn't available. It's the conditions, our relationship through conditioning of that experience, that makes it challenging to meet that experience. And we've been talking about ways to work with that. So any experience, we can be mindful of any experience. Another key understanding that happens as we are curious about our experience as human experience, something that we begin to see so clearly, is that experience is conditioned. This is a very powerful understanding. It helps us to recognize, you know, whatever's arising in this moment has come to be. And first of all, what is arising in this moment already is here. And so there's not, might as well look at it. Might as well meet it. And it has come to be, it's not just random, it has come to be based on conditions. Conditions from our history, conditions from how we engaged in the world, conditions from what our parents taught us, the views and perspectives that our parents offered us, the views and perspectives that we learned in school. All of this has shaped the conditions of being in a human body, the genetics that we carry. We can digest beans or we can't digest beans. This affects our experience. And so the conditions that are, what's arising right now is arising in dependence on conditions. And so it's not random. And as we start to see or recognize that things are conditioned, and we don't even have to see exactly how they are conditioned. Sometimes that can happen. We can see one thread of the arising of something. I've seen that at times, just one understanding that a thought arises in the mind, and then seeing how a kind of baggage is pulled up with that thought, and there's this inclination to jump on that thought and get entrenched in a reactive pattern of anger or frustration or self-hatred. So seeing that, the mind can kind of see this kind of causal, almost this conditioned pattern arising. And the seeing of that is very powerful. At one point in seeing that, the mind kind of saw the thought get picked up and then saw this kind of baggage get dragged up with it and felt the direction it was all headed. And in that moment, the mind understood that way lies suffering. And in that moment, wisdom allowed for the release of that whole direction. Very powerful to see that conditioning unfolding in the moment. But that is not always what we see. And we can't actually know all of the conditions that lead to any particular experience. The Buddha pointed to this, saying that we should not try to contemplate the vastness of karma. Karma being the word that describes all of the kind of intentions that come into the next, the arising of this moment and the stepping into the next moment. He said, trying to understand the entire web of that will drive you mad. And so he said, it's not useful to try to pick that all apart or figure out, okay, this moment, how did I get here? We could go back to the Big Bang to try to figure that one out. And so the Buddha said, that's not so useful. And yet every now and then we do see some particular aspect of suffering being put together in the moment. Like in that case that I described, the seeing of the kind of the intention or the mind's momentum towards, yeah, jump on that thought and think more thoughts to get angry at that person. And knowing that it was heading to suffering, you know, having seen that pattern head to suffering, the mind let it go. So this can be very powerful to see this kind of suffering, this kind of conditionality unfolding. But there have been many times in my practice where I simply recognize, right, this is conditioned. Don't know exactly how. Don't know all the pieces that come together with it, but just the recognition that experience is conditioned. And sometimes it's an understanding, a direct understanding, and sometimes it's more of a reflection. And we can use that, actually. We can use reflections to support orienting us towards this perspective of right view. Just reminding ourselves at times, if we're feeling that something is a particular struggle, we're caught by some particular habit or pattern, we might be able to just remind ourselves, right, of course this is happening. This is nature. That's the framing Sayadaw gives to this understanding of this is conditioned. It's like, this is nature. This is arising because of conditions. Nature is unfolding out of conditions. It's like, those trees out there are growing. It's nature that they're growing. At one point, a redwood cone dropped, or those shoots from another redwood tree just began, and that tree began. It's a process. It's growing out of conditions. And likewise for the arising of our whatever reactivity, whatever's happening in the moment. It's happening. It's like, oh, of course this bush is growing, this bush of anger. This has been conditioned in the past. This has been, I used the phrase yesterday, whatever we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of the mind. And so this is an expression of that. It's nature. That whatever's happening is nature. For me, that use of that has been so powerful as a reflection. If there's been a time when the mind is a little caught by something, self-hatred's arising. It's like, oh, God, I wish this weren't here. It's like, oh, this is nature. So many times I've used that phrase as a way to kind of create some balance. So this is one of those tools that can be used. Maybe one that you're familiar with, maybe not. You have your familiar tools for creating balance, but you could try this one on too. Using wisdom reflections, and the key wisdom reflections, the Buddha actually encouraged us to reflect, this is impermanent. This is unreliable. This is suffering. This is not self. The arising, whatever's arising, of course it's arising. Not me, not mine, not who I am, just an arising. And so we can use this right view as a perspective to support us. The second yogi job, be mindful. We've talked a lot about this, but I'll just remind you of a few pieces just to kind of pull the package together and then also to bring in a couple of elaborations. So one of the key ways we can cultivate mindfulness. So be mindful is also an encouragement to cultivate mindfulness. There's different ways into cultivating mindfulness. In the commentaries, it's spoken of that there's something called unprompted mindfulness and prompted mindfulness. And unprompted mindfulness is just the simple arising of mindfulness. What we've been talking about, the return of mindfulness. And we can, that will arise. That is just because we're human, that happens. And the perspective of right mindfulness, we can incline that arising of mindfulness towards. And more as mindfulness arises in this way, with this repeated cultivation of the perspective of right mindfulness, more and more the mindfulness that arises is right mindfulness. It is curious about what's happening right now. What is this experience? And so cultivating mindfulness is one of the powerful ways to cultivate mindfulness is to begin to recognize mindfulness itself. And this recognition of the moment of the arising of mindfulness, this unprompted mindfulness, this is one of the key ways to learn to recognize mindfulness, as we've talked about. Noticing the experience of mindfulness as it returns, the kind of difference between being mindful now and then the kind of lingering scent or lingering memory of what it was like a moment before when we weren't mindful. This begins to give us a taste of the felt sense of being mindful, of what that experience is. What's the experience of mindfulness? And so this unprompted mindfulness is a great place to begin to explore that. So we wake up and recognize that we are aware. A phrase that I found useful in that moment is, because by the time I'm able to recognize awareness, I'm already aware. And that phrase for me, already aware, has some potency to it. Already aware. No need to try to make awareness happen. Here it is. Already aware. So this is a piece of cultivating mindfulness, to recognize this mindfulness arising. The way mindfulness works, when we recognize a wholesome quality, we recognize mindfulness itself, it creates the conditions for that quality It strengthens that quality. When mindfulness meets a wholesome quality and it's recognized clearly, it's strengthened. Partly because of just the way our systems work, you know, our organism, our human system. My sense of it is that it wants to move in the direction of well-being. And so there's a pull in that direction towards well-being. And when mindfulness meets something that's wholesome, the mind just kind of groks, yes, this is helpful. This is leading towards well-being. And when the mindfulness meets reactivity, greed, aversion, delusion, again, the mind just gets it immediately. Yeah, this is not leading to well-being. And it was the absence of mindfulness of the greed, aversion, delusion, what, you know, the way we had been living before meeting this practice, the absence of mindfulness and greed, aversion, delusion. Greed, aversion, and delusion have their views and perspectives that I'm helping you. Greed thinks it's helping us by helping us to get something that we want. But greed is not aware of the suffering that's happening as the greed is going on. And so the mindfulness of that begins to recalibrate. Our system gets recalibrated. And so mindfulness, very naturally, this perspective of being curious about what's arising in the moment, as something arising in the moment, very naturally, wisdom grows about what leads to well-being and what doesn't lead to well-being. Our system understands that. It doesn't need to be told that. As it meets experience, it understands that directly. And this is a lot of where the wisdom comes. And so as mindfulness meets mindfulness, it understands that this is valuable, this is helpful. So it creates conditions for that to get stronger. Like the recognition of those moments of mindfulness returning, the noticing of that helps us to notice that it's happening more. It kind of sensitizes us to it, helps us to recognize that it actually happens a lot through the day. We can get kind of, if the mindfulness can get attuned to that experience of mindfulness re-arising, we'll start to see it happen so much. And that's a very powerful way and an actually very easeful way to begin to cultivate a kind of a continuity of mindfulness. Because that moment of recognizing mindfulness arising, you know, it's not that much effort. The mindfulness arose in and of its own nature. We didn't have to do that. There wasn't any prompting of that. It takes just the subtlest bit of connection to recognize, oh yeah, mindfulness is back, already aware. But it's not a lot of effort there. And then the prompted side of mindfulness, often in practices, we prompt mindfulness by remembering to connect with an object. So we prompt mindfulness by saying, yep, in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. Just remembering to connect with an experience, an object of mindfulness. In this style of practice, this more receptive style of practice, we're not orienting to connect with an object through intentionality. We're exploring what is coming into awareness. And so the prompting of mindfulness in this practice is this question, am I aware? We only can remember to ask that question when we're already aware. And this is the way prompted mindfulness works. When we're already aware, we remind ourselves, do it again, do it again, do it again. So this is the prompting of mindfulness. We connect with this quality and remind ourselves, this is helpful, keep doing it. Explore that possibility. And the question, am I aware? Is this kind of prompting? It also, in my own exploration of this question, you know, originally it's kind of like, well, Okay, if I'm already aware, why bother asking that question? I already know the answer is yes. But just the checking in, essentially that orientation towards that question, might be phrased more something like, what is it like to be aware? What is the experience of awareness? Because that, to me, is what this question has sparked the curiosity about. It's like, yes, I know I'm aware, but how? How do I know that I'm aware? And so the question is orienting us to be interested in the awareness itself. What is that experience? And again, as we've talked about, it may not be so obvious at first, but over time, we begin to get a sense, the taste, the felt sense of that, the quality of awareness. And as the mindfulness becomes more stable and more continuous, we get a sense of the feeling of kind of being on the ride of that mindfulness, catching that wave of mindfulness. What is it like to have mindfulness be here for a little while? We get a sense of that. And so this is leading to the third piece that Sayadaw pointed to, the continuity, practice mindfulness continuously. And he backed off of that because people were tying themselves into knots, trying to be continuous. And he said, of course you're not going to be able to be continuous. This is the intention. This is the direction. This is what we're inclining towards. But you're not going to be able to make it happen. And so there's some supports for this, supports for this continuity. And one of the key ones is just this gentle, persistent effort, the light touch. And just the reminding yourself of, all right, aware. And as I spoke about getting familiar with that momentum of mindfulness, as we begin to get a sense of what it's like to be mindful and have that mindfulness flowing for a little while, then we also can start to get familiar with what it's like for that momentum to kind of begin to break down. I used the scooter analogy in one of the groups this morning about this kind of effort, this light touch of mindfulness, like riding on a scooter. I don't think I said that in this retreat yet in the hall. As a child rides on one of those little kick scooters, not a motorized scooter, they're tapping the ground gently to get the momentum going. And it's a light touch, you know, it's just a light tap, tap, tap to get the momentum going. And so it's gentle. It's just this lightness. You could potentially put your foot down and like go, I want to get going fast, so let me push really hard. But that creates an unstable momentum for that scooter. Much more effective to do this light touch. And likewise with the mindfulness, just this gentle, oh, am I aware? And now, how about now? How about now? Getting familiar with that, just light touch of reminding ourselves to be aware. And that creates, like with the scooter, creates a kind of momentum of the mindfulness. And as with the scooter, when you're riding a scooter, you get familiar with while you're riding, you get going for a little while, you don't have to push. In fact, it gets in the way to tap when you've got a momentum going. It kind of slows you down. And so likewise, with the when we get a sense of that momentum of mindfulness, reminding yourself to be mindful while you're already in a kind of momentum of mindfulness, that's like getting in the way. Joseph said, you're trying to turn on the light switch and the light's already on. So that sense of being familiar with what it's like for the light to be on. So get familiar with that feeling. And then we start to also get familiar with the feeling of that wobbliness. Like on the scooter, we get familiar with this wobbly quality, and then it's time to put the foot down and tap a couple times more gently and ride again. And so beginning to get familiar with this experience of the momentum of mindfulness, we can use that as a kind of a, and when it starts to kind of feel like it's it's falling apart, that's when to bring back in the, oh, right, aware. And it may at that point, it may just be, oh, right, already aware, but the feeling of it kind of beginning to kind of lose touch, but we haven't lost it yet. So I was like, yeah, still aware. Just a gentle connection of reminding. Yep, still aware. Kind of to bring in a little bit of that connection with the experience of mindfulness again. To the light touch, gentle, persistent effort around being mindful. And then another really valuable support for the continuity is curiosity. Can we be curious about what's happening? This curiosity, when we tap into being curious about, wow, this thing is arising, what, this bush is growing, what kind of bush is this? It creates a very natural kind of effort. The curiosity kind of spurs or inclines us to a very natural kind of interest in meeting what's happening. So when we're curious about experience, we're more likely to maintain the mindfulness. A question that sometimes can be interesting to spark some curiosity. What else is happening right now? There's always something happening that we're not quite aware of. So just like, not as a kind of a searching for, but just more as a kind of opening. What else is going on right now? Is there something being missed right now? So light touch of effort supports the continuity of mindfulness. Curiosity can be a motivator for continuity. Also understanding the value of the practice. How helpful it is. Sometimes we can just reflect on this. If we're feeling like our sense of connection with experience is wavering, or we're getting bored, or we're feeling like, what use is this anyway? Or why am I practicing anyway? You know, this just seems so silly to sit here and just receive, receive, receive. There must be something more I can do. So if you have a place or a time where the mind is kind of, doubt is arising, essentially, kind of a doubt around, why am I doing this? Or what's the purpose here? It can be useful to remind yourself of the benefit that you have experienced because of the practice. Sometimes I think back on my life before practice, and it's like it's a different person. You know, a person who was largely miserable, feeling put upon by the world. That being, it's like that being just seems to have transformed. So the real sense of the value of the practice, of how it has created so much freedom from suffering. So reminding ourselves of that value can be helpful. Sayadaw says often, I've heard him say it many times, if we really understood, if we fully understood how valuable the practice is, we would not stop practicing. And so, again, this is kind of a reflection. It's a reminding ourselves of what is, how have we benefited? What is the value of practice? And then another way to explore supporting continuity is that's connected with curiosity, because it's helpful to have some curiosity about this particular aspect, just to be curious where mindfulness gets lost, where do we lose mindfulness, how does that happen. It's easy to see mindfulness returning. Often when we notice kind of a sense of where mindfulness got lost. At first, we notice a sense of where mindfulness got lost in retrospect. We may be pretty present as we get up from our sitting and walk down into the line, and then sometime later, we're eating lunch, and it's, wow, last time I was mindful, I remember clearly walking down the stairs and seeing the line. That's the last thing I remember being mindful of. And here I am eating lunch already. So there was a gap in there. There was a loss of mindfulness. And so we can begin to see kind of habits or patterns of losing mindfulness. Maybe we tend to lose mindfulness in particular times of the day, going through the lunch line or going into our rooms, using the bathroom or the time between sitting and walking. Maybe there are these little mindfulness sinks, little gaps that tend to be habitual. And so we can be curious about those. So the curiosity here is not to try to say, okay, I know I tend to lose mindfulness as I go downstairs, so I'm going to make myself be mindful while I walk down the stairs. I'm going to be mindful while I stand in that line. There can be some value to that because it helps to create some continuity, but it's missing some of the what happens in that moment. Especially if there's a habitual thing, like we go into our rooms and close the door and mindfulness goes, it's like, what happens in there? Can you be curious about what happens to lose mindfulness instead of simply trying to force mindfulness? Oh, it's kind of like, okay, I'm heading in this place of losing mindfulness. Let's see if I can see where the mind kind of begins to leave. So beginning to notice that wobbliness. And so we might notice as we walk down the stairs, seeing the line, a little bit of a sinking feeling. Oh, it's going to be 10 minutes in that line. Maybe that's where the wobbly comes in. Oh, sinking feeling. That's what's happening right now. Can I know that? So just, you know, this curiosity of these places, when we find there are places in our day where we lose mindfulness, bringing some curiosity to that. And likewise with all of these kind of different ways we might be curious about losing mindfulness, curiosity is key. Not this, the exercise around being curious about where we lose mindfulness isn't to double down and say, I am going to be mindful while this happens. But be curious about what's the sticky bit? What's the part where the mind kind of picks up something and runs and charges with it? What is that? When we can see it happening, there's something that can be learned there. Some new understanding around where we get caught, how we get stuck, where craving kind of pulls us out and creates suffering. So we could also, we tend to lose awareness in particular habits of mind, you know, familiar. We all have our own favorite moods or emotions that we get caught in. You know, for me, self-hatred, anger, these were the biggies. Impatience, another biggie. And so curiosity, again, about that, it's like at one point practicing around impatience, it's like I saw that this was a big thing. And I noticed impatience in a lot of big areas. And so I just began to, it's like I got curious about, okay, well, can I notice impatience? Can I be curious about when that happens? It was everywhere. It was when I picked up my toothbrush. it was stunning how deeply conditioned that pattern was. I hadn't really noticed all the little ways in which that pattern was entrenched. It came into my awareness in the big times, you know, maybe even middling times, like when I'm sitting at a stoplight, you know, it's like impatience arising there. And so, the curiosity about it, it might help to create the conditions to see it more. And this means the practice is working. It doesn't mean it's making it worse. It's revealing what's there. And so again, curiosity about these habitual, familiar kind of mind states. And sometimes when we see, especially the habitual, familiar ones, the big ones, you know, they are most likely also playing out in thousands of tiny little ways in our day. And so when we can start to see those little tiny, like little filaments of those states, it's often easier to be with it when it's small, when it's not like the picking up of the toothbrush and seeing the flash of impatience. It's like, that's a lot easier to be with than the impatience around something big. But it's the same pattern. It's the same. There's something we can learn there. And meeting the smaller ones gives us some strength and some familiarity with being able to hold it in the bigger, more reactive times. There's lots of different ways we can play with this, noticing where we lose awareness. And so I'll ask you to just be curious for yourself. Where do you lose awareness? And be curious about that, not to try to force yourself to be mindful, but just be curious, what's happening? Maybe the last one I'll mention from my own practice was habitually getting lost in sloth and torpor, spacing out, that kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of states of mind that we habitually, let's say there's a strong habitual tendency, not just for an individual, but in the human condition, it seems that sleepiness, being asleep, is a habitually non-mindful experience. So you don't have to take it personally. And yet to be curious about it, because it is actually possible to be mindful. It is possible to be mindful while we're sleeping. My own experience, it arose through seeing the falling asleep process and noticing kind of the shift into sleep and being aware in sleep. But aside from that kind of mind-blowing kind of experience of like, wow, that's possible. I mean, that experience actually was one of those experiences that said, okay, I believe it. We can be mindful of anything. It's just, this mind hasn't quite understood, you know. So just keep trying. Be curious. You know, the mindfulness is getting lost in that experience. Let's see if the mind can kind of follow it. So that experience for me was one of those like, yeah, okay, I get it. Mindfulness is that strong, is that powerful. But even things like spaciness and, you know, dullness of mind. You know, we might think those are, you know, inherently non-mindful. Spacing out, you know, by its very definition, we think of it as non-mindful. But it is just habitually non-mindful. That's what the mind tends to do in that state. Not inherently non-mindful. And so again, a curiosity around, well, how might it be possible to be mindful in that state? And in my experience, what's not so possible is to say, I'm going to be mindful while I go into spacing out. You know, that doesn't seem to be the way it works. But as a momentum of mindfulness develops, if we have the curiosity and interest and have the sense of, yes, it is possible for mindfulness to go in places where I might not think it's possible, then there can be a kind of a momentum of mindfulness and that can follow the mind state into spacing out. So at one point, I was noticing that the mind was spacing out a lot in one morning. And I would just wake up and notice that spacing out. And at that point, in the first half of this experience, I had this kind of view of like, right, spacing out, not mindful, come back. Being mindful means being with what I'm doing. Here I am eating, be present with the eating. And then it kept happening over and over again, spacing out. At some point, the mind got curious about that spacing out and kind of noticed, and this is a place where we can kind of be curious about the mind letting go of, or the mindfulness kind of releasing. Maybe this is a little bit of similar flavor of the mindfulness getting wobbly in a way. And yet, instead of thinking, oh, mindfulness is getting wobbly, let me connect back to something. But what the exploration was is, oh, the mind is letting go of this doing, of being present with this eating. What's it doing? And the mind just kind of was followed into the state of what actually was experienced in that moment, not as being disconnected, what we think of as being spaced out, but of resting. That the state that the mind was moving towards was that of rest. And in seeing that, you know, so the mindfulness had let go of the attention to what I had been directing it to. Kind of like this is, again, I was talking earlier, like sometimes when the mind wanders, it's wandering into releasing something. It's wandering into letting go sometimes. Not always. And this was a case. The mind was letting go. It was like, you know, you're not doing this right. You are doing way too much work. Let me show you what's going on here. And basically, the mindfulness let go of the being with the directing attention and just took a rest. And I was perfectly present for that resting. And it hung out there for 30 seconds, something like that. And then it was like that state just dissipated, kind of like the fog dissipates on a sunny day. That state dissipated. And then there was a kind of a clarity of being with my body and eating. And so the mindfulness kind of learned something about that. It learned that, well, actually, one of the things I learned was I was trying too hard. I was doing too much with the practice. And the mind was kind of tired. It needed a rest. And it was going to take its rest whether I was willing to give it or not. So there, it took its rest. And being aware of it, you know, when it took its rest and I went yanking it back to be aware, it had to keep trying to take its rest. After I was aware of that process, it was like that piece passed and the mind was refreshed. And so this, you know, these places, there's a lot of states of mind that we think not possible to be mindful of. And if you're losing awareness in some kind of a state where there's that kind of belief, see if you can borrow some of my confidence that we can be mindful of anything. Maybe it'll take a little kind of curiosity and willingness. I mean, it sometimes takes willingness to let the mindfulness slip out, willingness to lose mindfulness in order to watch the mind shift into a state that is habitually non-mindful. And so again, it's not something we can try to prompt our mindfulness into, but more as the mindfulness get stronger when we don't have the view, oh, that state, that's not a good state, better not go there. The mindfulness can begin to expand into some of these edges of our practice. And so really the practice is simple. I mean, these are a lot of words. But it's very simple. Relax. And the instructions really encompass the view. Relax. Are you aware? What is happening in this moment? Can you be curious about this moment? And the checking the attitude also really brings in the perspective of right view. As we check the attitude, we see and feel when that attitude has the feeling of not heading to well-being. So this is another way that the instructions bring us to the kind of mindfulness that frees. It's very simple. Relax. Recognize awareness. Receive experience. Allow what's here to be here. That piece too embeds the right view, the allowing what's here. And from time to time, checking our relationship to experience. Cultivate right view. Be mindful. Recognize mindfulness. And encourage the continuity of mindfulness.